We welcome you this morning to a presentation by a distinguished colleague from a neighboring academic institution just on the other side of the river. Very glad for the expressway, which has really promoted the cause of academic communication between our schools. It's now only 35 minutes on the expressway from the campus of Concordia Seminary to that of SIU Edwardsville. Those of us who don't generally take that particular rabbit run still have a mental image of a long and difficult journey over there. This is not true. Happily, the way is just as short this way as it is in that direction. So we're very happy that we could invite this morning Professor Richard Millett, member of the History Department under the Social Sciences Division, and chairman of the Latin American Studies Committee at Southern Illinois University. Professor Millett is very well conversant with Spanish. He's traveled widely. He knows the bus routes, the burro trails in much of Latin America. And his doctoral dissertation is going to be published in Spanish by the combined university press of five Central American universities this summer, after undergraduate work at Harvard. He earned his doctorate in Latin American studies closer to the Mexican border at the University of New Mexico. And we appreciate the fact that we've been able to enjoy close and good relationships with Professor Millett through our Latin America secretary, Brother Fred Pankow. And Professor Millett has also appeared in lecture at mission board meetings. Having now successfully used up the time till exactly 11:15, I give you at once Professor Millett.
I've had lots of introductions, but I don't think every one that was designed largely to kill time before. I don't know whether to thank you or they probably will afterwards for taking away another couple minutes from me. Anyone who asks me to speak and answer questions in 45 minutes on something that I offer a four-unit course in and is asking for it to begin with, I think he figured the only way he could shut me up was to schedule me right before lunch and hope my stomach pangs got to me by noon. I thought of, several things I could do today. I could give the typical kind of scholarly paper. I even have a scholarly paper, which I've given before if I got really lazy and if I hadn't resolved my own crisis. We had a large crisis at home today. It's called Crisis in the Sewer. It backed up on us. And so, if you don't want to get downwind of me, I came straight from that to here. But I could give this academic paper on crisis in Latin American Protestantism. I could quote statistics, or I could give you an impassioned plea for more involvement with Latin America. I've done that before, speaking to church groups, wave your arms and make very emotional pleas, and watch somebody falling asleep in the fifth pew. Or I could play the down with all the gringos but me role, and denounce American imperialism endlessly. But none of this would seem to have really a very great relevance to a group which are involved not predominantly in Latin America, but with American churches, with either planning to serve American churches, with preparing those who will serve the churches. And so I've tried to think of what can I give you that will actually, relate to the world you live in, at the same time relate to the Latin American world in which I am so personally involved. And for me, it is a personal involvement. I've never been one of those, you know, who's tried to pretend he was a Latin, you know, to wrap myself in a serape and carry around a used tortilla all day. It has never struck me as the most youthful way of approaching Latin America. I'm not Latin. You know, soy gringo. I'm a North American. And there's no way I can get out of it. And to pretend that I'm not North American would be absurd. Pretend that I love everything about Latin America and, you know, just don't like anything about my own culture would be nonsense. There's a lot of things. The stopped up sewer reminded me of Latin America again. Because one thing I appreciate here is that if you're downtown, there are public restrooms. In most of Latin America, that is a search. It really is. So, yeah, there are things, you know, you really appreciate. When I've been in Latin America for a couple of months, I'm usually glad to get back to the United States. When I've been back to the United States for a couple hours, I'm usually anxious to get back to Latin America. But you try to strike a balance. So I'll try to stick to the theme of trying to give you a basic review of Latin American reality as it affects especially the Christian churches. This has been the area of most of my research in recent years. My dissertation is the history of the Nicaraguan army, so I fiddle around with things besides churches. In fact, maybe simply because I couldn't stand dictators and militarists anymore, that I began to try to work with church people and find a somewhat more hopeful view of history and of current Latin American existence. As you know, Latin America traditionally is thought of as a very Catholic continent. Indeed, Catholicism had a virtual monopoly on Latin America until probably the post-World War I period. Oh, you had a few groups of Lutheran immigrants, but generally kept very much to themselves, a few Anglicans settling on the Caribbean coast, sometimes slaves who originally escaped from the Caribbean islands, settled along Central America's Caribbean coast. You had a very few Protestant missions in Mexico, in Guatemala, where the government brought them in as part of a ploy in a church-state conflict. They, you know, they wanted to throw the Jesuits out, and they didn't have any Guatemalans to teach school, so they brought the Presbyterians in. Whether a trading, you know, a Presbyterian for a Jesuit is a good trade or not, I don't know. I'd suggest you consult Red Shandines, who seems to be more of an expert on trading people around like this than myself. But in general, this was considered a very Catholic continent. Indeed, the Catholic Church continued to maintain up till the post-World War II period that missions in Latin America were an absolute affront. This was a Christianized continent. And suddenly, in the early 1950s, you got a rash of books from Catholic scholars saying, whoops, you know, it isn't. Whatever it isn't Christian. One priest put it rather bluntly. He said, we've been baptizing spiritual animals there for the last 400 years. And the Catholic Church suddenly rediscovered Latin America as a mission field. And Protestants, too, suddenly began to pour increased efforts. There had been efforts without too great success between the First and Second World War, but in the post-World War II period, partly because I think of a release of missionaries from the Far East. They began to find Brazil more attractive than China after 1949. Partly because of the tremendous growth of indigenous movements, notably the Pentecostal churches, you had a tremendous upsurge, a fantastic upsurge, in Latin American Protestantism. So much so that a Catholic document published a few years ago said that the Catholic Church had lost more souls to Protestantism, you may not like their wording, had lost more souls in 20th century Latin America than it did in 16th century Europe. And today, if you try to estimate the total size of the Protestant community, and you have to talk about community, and you know, because you're counting children who are, most of these churches baptize and admit only adults to membership, you're talking somewhere between 15 and 20 million people. It's a very sizable Protestant group. So the traditional patterns then have been breaking down. At the same time, the place of the Roman Catholic Church has been breaking down. The church traditionally was one of the pillars of society, of the established order. It was the symbol of all things that would maintain the status quo. You had the large landowners, the foreign investors, the Catholic Church, and usually the military. And these were the corners of your table that supported a very, very traditional society. And yet these pillars have been crumbling one by one The church itself has tried to radically re-examine its position. This is one of the first elements in what I call the crisis in Latin American Christianity, because I think it is a real crisis. Can an institution, which is such an integral part of an established, and one must say generally, very solidified, very reactionary order, extract itself from this order and become a part and changing it without destroying itself in the process? Because it is so identified with the very things that are now under such constant attack throughout the hemisphere. What are the factors that are producing the change? Some are obvious. You could talk about a demographic crisis. There's some dispute over the extent of it. But it's obvious that Latin America has the highest population growth rate of any continent in the world. Considerably higher than Asia's. Much, much higher than Africa's. And certainly infinitely higher than our own or Western Europe's. In some countries, this has approached 4% a year. Which means when you put in multiplier factors that the population doubles in considerably less than 20 years. Now, in Brazil, parts of Argentina, there are still areas, you know, with land, relatively settleable, and not fully occupied. But there are countries like El Salvador and Haiti, which have been overcrowded for years already. I remember a Salvadorian priest telling me that he lived in the only country in the world where people died falling out of their cornfields. And you look at the cultivation, and this is just true. You know, they're cultivating everything. These countries have a population density which is starting to approach that of Belgium, and yet, or Netherlands, and yet these are, you know, highly industrialized countries. Haiti, Salvador, are overwhelmingly agricultural. So, there is a tremendous population pressure. There is an urbanization pressure. There is a major migration from rural areas into the cities, which has crowded people together, which has brought, for every new job open in the cities, has brought two new people in, has left them without basic urban services, has destroyed the traditional village type of life. This creates, again, considerable political pressure. Then there is that most subversive instrument ever invented by man, and I don't refer to the anarchist time bomb or to distributed copies of Das Kapital in Spanish. I refer to the Japanese transistor radio. And if you want to subvert a society, you just make a $3 transistor radio. Now, you've got a guy who may not be able to afford shoes. He's got one of these things today. And suddenly there's a new world out there. There's a world of visible change. There's a world of radical plasticity. His horizon has been very closed for centuries or open. And this creates pressures. Well, if all these pressures are affecting the Catholic Church, they are also affecting the Protestants. Protestants have had a traditional self-image, that they are a small, persecuted minority, politically, basically impotent, dependent upon foreign support. Something has happened. It's very hard to say that you are the little tiny persecuted minority when in Haiti, definitely, and perhaps in Chile and Brazil, even, on average, something, there are as many Protestants as Catholics in Haiti, more Protestants. Yeah. Right, Protestants go to church, and doesn't, your image. How can you be the little persecuted minority? And then there's the trouble with the Catholic Church. You know, it used to be, you know, you would schedule a meeting, you know, and you'd have a point in the service for the Catholic to throw rocks in the room. And you could encourage it. If they didn't throw soon enough, you'd yell the Pope in the bunk. You'd go over and make but today, things have changed completely. I remember talking to a very, very fundamentalist American down to Latin America to save the heathen. And he came from
Texas, and I assumed you thought there were no heathen there. I have a different impression of that. Do we have a shot?
Anyway, he'd gone to language school in Costa Rica, and having finally mastered enough Spanish, he was allowed to go out in the field and practice for the first time, and he was out to confront the devil. He knew he was out there, so he got, along with a couple others in a jeep, went out to his rural village to distribute copies of the New Testament in Spanish, the American Bible Society edition. He actually got along with it, which is the same as good news for modern man, at least in the lines of it. When he got out there, he got out with his box of Bibles and unloaded them. Here came this figure from the flat. Wrapped his mother together for and he knew he was in for it, The priest said, "What are you doing here?" And he was going to stand up for the faith. He said, "I'm here to give the people the word of God." He pulled it out. And the priest said, "Wonderful! I'll go ring the church bell for some of the congregation and give it to all of them." I saw the man a week later and didn't recover yet.
This was not the way the script read. It's easy to know what to do when the Catholic priest denounces you and throws stones on the roof of your church. But when he rings the church bell to help you give out the Bible, this is destroying your official position. How do you react to this? And then there's the problem of foreign ties, which are a very real problem today. If the Catholics are stuck with being part of the established order, the Protestants are identified with what many Latin Americans see as what today is the primary supporter of the established order in the United States. They have been attacks upon Protestants as agents of American imperialism in Latin America for 50, 60 years. The Latins have loved to quote a rather interesting line by Theodore Roosevelt to the effect that the absorption of the Latin American countries by the United States would be very difficult as long as the majority of their population was Catholic. Evidently, Roosevelt did say something like that. He's simply saying, really, we don't want to make them stay. This would create some domestic political thing. It wasn't a tactical, so let's go make them all Protestant statement. But this has been used ever since. But in a period of growing nationalism, in a period where Latin America is finally getting tired of being a recipient culture, where it draws its examples, its models, its goals from abroad, where they are seeking to develop distinctly Latin models, to be identified with the United States, to be singing horrible translations of Annie Crosby in church, and to have every basic decision made back in an American office, is an utter disaster. The Latin handles it in some very interesting ways. I met with a Venezuelan who is in charge of Protestant student work at the National University in Caracas, a couple professors from the National University, a professor from the National Normal School, and a couple students. The meeting was arranged by some North American missionaries. In their house, initially. And it was very interesting. The Venezuelan came in and started to tell me, "Oh, we have this many Bible studies going," and, that's the regular rigmarole. And I said, "Hey, we shouldn't be sitting here. These people have got kids. Let's go across the street where there's a driver and talk over there." So they get up and went over. I said, "Look, I'm not here representing any mission board. I'm a prophet here under a grant from the American Philosophical Society." And I really am not interested in statistics, as to how many Bible studies and films and conversions you record. I said, "What I'm really interested in is finding out what you see as the future of the church, what you see as the problems." And I said, and here's what I see. And I said, "I think the only future for the Latin American church is in the struggle, the work to create a church which is first Latino, Latin, second, independent, and third, truly evangelical, truly Christian." And when we revived them after that, they said, "You really believe that?" And I said, "Yeah, there's no future for this church with the reflection of the American church." And that started them off. I just sat back for the next hour. They told me which missionaries God should send cyanide to. On and on, it was the first North American, you know, ever, you know, come on this way, and the first one that wasn't going to go back and say, cut off the funds. But you get just a complete change in personnel. As soon as they discovered I had no particular access where I can help, so I had no source to any funds. So there's no way they could result me in losing money. I didn't have any. I still don't. But this feeling goes very deep. Sometimes it reminds you of putting on old Massa. It's hidden a bit from the Americans who go down, but it is really there. And it's seen by them as a deep problem. If I someone say, this guy is the most loving, wonderful, hopeless obstacle that we encounter. You know, he means so well and he knows so little. And you'll find. Even the Southern Baptists now have become aware this is a problem. To be a slap at the Southern Baptists, but they are usually the last to become aware of most problems in Latin America. Even they are trying to nationalize, trying to find some way to Latinize, if I mean steal a word from Richard Nixon, to Latinize their programs. But they still have this highly paternalistic mentality. The thing is, we will decide when the Latins are ready to take over. You can't work that way. As long as you're saying, we'll decide when you're ready, you aren't letting anybody else take it. You're becoming the ultimate patron. Latin America has this, the patron bit, where it's the guy in the big house who dispenses the little gifts, and you take off your hat and shuffle your feet when he comes by. And the missionaries stay in this position. We're going to keep the right to decide when you're mature enough. Only Americans have the right to make ghastly mistakes. Well, we've been exercising that right in Latin America for a long time. And I'm sure it'll continue for the next few years. But the point is, Latins have to have the right to be wrong. They have to have the right to make mistakes. And I think, bluntly, we have to admit that they are probably going to have a little better understanding of what their culture and society needs than we do. But all of these pressures, combined with the fact that for the first time you have a numerous second generation of Protestants, with all the generational gap, with all the questioning of the beliefs of their fathers, it's still a much younger church than the church in the United States, but you're getting a second generation. This is producing a gap. You're getting all the international liberal conservative things pushed in on them. And I must say that I have no more sympathy for religious cultural imperialism for the left than I do from the right. There's nothing better than somebody who's sitting in New York planning the Latin Americans' revolution for them. Flies down, says, this is what you do. Gets on his jet and flies back and says, anybody going to be killed by it? Somebody usually is, but it's never him. Not unless by some great divine intervention, jet crashes. These people, with their own programs, planning revolutions for the Latins, again, are no better than those on the right who want the Latin American church to be the exact model of American suburbia. This has been another crisis they've gone through, led to things like Extension Seminary. Their seminaries were set up to train, ministers for Webster Groves. But unfortunately, there aren't any Webster Groves in Latin America. The average congregation can't possibly afford to support somebody with this kind of level of education. Suburban communities are very rare, and yet we trained them on the American suburban model. Again, we sang the American suburban hymns and scheduled the church services the American suburban hours. And the Latins are saying enough of this. They mean to say the seminaries are nice, they're wonderful, they're useless. And so we've gone to extension seminaries. I'm sure, Bill, you've talked about this trend quite a bit, and you're probably much more knowledgeable on it than I am. But an attempt to bring training to the people. One of the more interesting experiments I ran into was by the Baptists in Nicaragua. They had a whole bunch of churches, and just like the Catholics, a desperate shortage of ministers. They had some people who wanted to be ministers, and they found out that the average level of these people, some of them were already in charge of local churches, they had an average of a third or fourth grade education. So they combine seminary with elementary school. These people get a seminary certificate and complete junior high school simultaneously. Now, of course, you go to a different seminary curriculum, but it's one of the more realistic steps I've ever seen. Instead of saying, when you get your bachillerato, which is what you get when you graduate from a Latin American high school, when you've got all of this, then you can come to us.
In the meantime, you can get nothing unless you want to enroll in Moody Bible Institute's correspondence course in Spanish. They have gone to the level that people are at. And they've tried to raise their overall level of education. It's been a very difficult thing. It's much more difficult now because the seminary, unfortunately, is laying flat, along with virtually everything else in Nicaragua. You should have said 4.5 national universities instead of 5, because half of Nicaragua is in Managua and it fell down. For the book I'm publishing, which is on the Nicaraguan army, not on the church. So with all of these problems, the Protestant church is groping for a new identification, a new sense of reason for existence, a new way of relating to its society. The old model of that little persecuted group supported from abroad just doesn't work. There is no future in it. It grew for a while. That growth has stopped. And look at the growth statistics. The more a church tends to identify with that in most areas, the less it's growing these days, especially in areas where it's been for several years. It may, still be able to find new areas where nobody's been. But you're getting in the more developed, the more urban areas, these groups, they're stagnant. They're stuck on dead center. What does all this mean to a North American? How on earth do we relate to it? We've got some real problems. One of the first problems is, how do you know what's going on? If you believe what you read in the papers, you've got real problems. Professor Danker and I were at a convention, the Catholic Inter-American Cooperation Program in Dallas past weekend, and it was fascinating to read about the convention of the Dallas News, because you were sure they were reporting another one. It wasn't the one you'd been in. You listened to a guy make a speech for an hour and a quarter, you read the account of the Dallas News, and it was somebody else's speech. There was one line he said, I think taken wildly out of context and everything elaborated on that. And if it's this bad, what's going on? If they can't even report accurately what happens in Dallas, you could picture the kind of coverage you're getting out of Brazil. So we have a tremendous lack of decent information. I had my students in my 20th century Latin American history course. I said, look, I don't want you to do anything special. This is no assignment, but just note down anytime and anything you'd read anyway. You read the papers, read Time, read Newsweek, or listen to the radio, or watch television. Everything you hear about Latin America in the space of 1 week. Just make a quick note as to what the content was. But, don't do any extra reading. Please don't read one extra line or turn on one extra news program. You wouldn't have otherwise. Because I just wanted to see what exposure they were getting. It was terrifying. There were 3 bus crashes, and a folklore carnival someplace, and an American citizen being arrested, and one demonstration against Allende. And that's it. And aside from that, for an entire week, Latin America didn't exist for a class of about 35 university students, with, I would assume, more than a normal level of interest for the population in what's going on in the world. So you've got a real problem of information. We've got a problem of language, although if you want to understand the third world, Latin America may offer less of this than any place else, unless you really want to get in with a Mayan or a Quechua or Aymara Indians. Because Spanish, I would think, is a lot easier to learn than most of the Asian or Middle Eastern or African languages for the average American. It's a Latin-based language. Instruction on it is widely available. Pick it up a lot easier. You can find a lot more to read in it. You can find more opportunities to use it, even in this country, to keep it up. But language is a barrier. If you don't understand a language, it's extremely hard to understand a culture. And Americans are notoriously horrible in our approach to languages. And thirdly, there's what I call the existential barrier. And this hits me as much as it does. You can't really understand Latin America. You walk in the market and inhale deeply. You don't know really the other way out. You see a person barefoot selling shoelaces for a living. You can see some of the incongruity. But there's more to it than this. I could talk about hunger and its effect. But what do I mean by hunger? There has never been a day in my life when, if I was hungry, I couldn't go to the refrigerator and get something. And, putting myself on a voluntary fast is nothing. Because that's voluntary. I chose to. For the average Latin American, there's never been a day in his life when, if he was hungry, he could count on being able to go to the cupboard, the refrigerator, and get something. And that's a contrast. How are you going to relate to that? And I admit, for me, it's an awful problem. And again, there's no way to Latinize it. They talk about the Peace Corps people who went in and lived with the people and tried to identify. I heard one Latin saying, yeah, but it's phony. He says, because I know one thing. He says, if they get sick, say they get appendicitis.
They'll be in the doctor's hands an hour, and I'll plane out of the country if they need it that afternoon. And if I get sick of the same thing, I'm dead.
Very hard to get too much existential reality when this is the way things are. Or try to relate to a peasant culture. You could try to understand it, but you're not going to think like a peasant. You're not going to have those same kind of values. There is a totally different mindset. My biggest task with students is not to get them to think like peasants. Some of them on exams write like them, maybe. But to get them to admit that there are other legitimate ways of looking at the world than Western middle class. That there are other possible ways, and it's not just a question of being stupid if you don't share Western middle class values. But we have these kinds of barriers to understanding. And so we sometimes opt for the two extremes. You ignore it. You know, well, the only people down there are, you know, if only they'd work harder, for instance. I met a Salvadorian once who worked 110-hour week. In his off hours, he was working, cleaning out a general factotum in a pension, a boarding house. In his off hours, he got to sleep in front of the door at night to keep burglars from coming in. This was his rest. He worked a 14-hour day, 6.5 days a week, plus sleeping in front of the door. It's incredible. Almost 100-hour week really added up for him. But it's incredible. Somebody wants him to work harder. If he saved all his salary for 2 years, he could buy a bicycle. A real upward mobility there. And he was lucky. He had a job. He was saying, you know, I'm one of the lucky ones. In this country, too many people. Those who can't work beg, and those who can't be successful begging steal. And those who aren't successful begging or stealing die. And that's the reality. Well, you can ignore this. Or we can go to faddism. You know, we can... Again, wrap ourselves in our serapes if you want to, or you could pick up a new idea. You know, we will suddenly embrace the theology of liberation, which I think has some merit. But it's a Latin theology. It speaks to Latin conditions. You don't try to, you know, the Latins have finally learned that trying to impose Western models in their society is crazy. And so they're developing their own models, and I meet dozens of Americans who are now trying to repeat the thing the Latins did wrong for 400 years and impose Latin American models on our society. So you can get fat, and you can suddenly discover this is the solution. I have found the way. I have found the one thing. You know, if Fidel doesn't turn out to be God's second son, maybe Allende will make it. We have this tendency to overcommit yourself to individuals, to new ideas. Perhaps, again, out of the frustration of the general situation. But I see this as no help to anybody. I think there are some new voices you ought to listen to. My favorite is the Archbishop of Olinda Recife, Brazil, who has been nominated again, along with Richard Nixon, for the Nobel Peace Prize, I think. Archbishop Elder Comrade has a slightly better chance. It's hard to pin on any school, social liberation theology, social critiques of development. He's active in UNCTAD, the United Nations Council on Trade and Development. He's very much associated with nonviolence. As a philosophy, as a way of life. But Dom Elder's thesis is that the real hope in the Christian world lies not in the developed countries, but in the underdeveloped countries. You see, he does a few things. He's really very Catholic, a very Christian man. He takes, for instance, the Bible seriously, a very dangerous thing to do. And when he reads in Corinthians that God isn't going to use the strong and the powerful and the rich of this world, he believes it. He actually believes that God isn't going to use the strong and powerful and rich countries. Somehow or other, that seems to have dropped out of most American theology, that particular section. But he takes it seriously. He says that the poor countries still have their options open to them, that we are stuck with our consumerism. And they yell and rail against it. And nothing funnier to me than to see a rock group with $5,000 worth of amplifiers announcing material. I gather somebody else has seen that. But he says, we're stuck with this. And he's right. You know, for me, it's real psychological pain when my air conditioner breaks down. He says, the third world still has a chance to avoid consumerism. Still has a chance to avoid this particular kind of enslavement. There's an enslavement of poverty. He doesn't romanticize it. Poverty does not produce virtue. and greatness, poverty produces pain, and he knows it. He's lived among it all his life. But it does still leave options open. And so Dom Elder and others. Are any of you familiar with the work of Denis Goulet?
Have you read The Cruel Choice? You ought to assign it. Cruel Choice by Denis Goulet is an attempt to criticize the Western model of development from a moral, ethical, Christian context. There are a few other
ways. Say, what do we really mean by development? This is one of the questions Dom Elder asks. Do we measure it in anything but refrigerators per capita? Automobiles? Are you developed if you increase your cases of bronchitis and emphysema because of air pollution? Are you developed if deaths from malnutrition go down and deaths from suicide and alcoholism and traffic crashes go up? How do you measure it? The Latins are asking this. They're asking us basically to stop and say, what really are your values in the society? How have you defined the good life? If you simply, it is assumed again, in one of the rewritten versions of the Bible we seem to use, that a man's life does consist in the abundance of material things he possesses. And so they're questioning this whole basic thesis of what constitutes humanness. What make conditions what they call infrahumana, subhuman, non-human? What is the quality of life really all about? And I think they're in a much better position to question it than we are, because they aren't as tied up with the things that have just got us ensnared. So I think there is a place for us to begin to look, to begin to listen. Not to embrace wholeheartedly. You know, I said I'm very impressed with Dom Elder, but I'm not going to run around and become his disciple and announce that he's got all the answers for us. I'm not sure he's got all the answers for Brazil. I don't think he thinks he does. I think he's finally asking the right questions. The same is true with the theology of hope, Ruben Alves, the theology of liberation, which are coming out of Latin America. And they ask some very basic questions about the relationship of faith to life, about the relationship of Christian faith to the social, economic, and political situation in which man finds himself. They ask it because the crisis I've been describing makes them ask. If your society really is in a critical stage, there is an incredible amount of human inertia. We don't tend to change things as we have to. We don't want to question them until they fall apart on our hands. Well, in Latin America, the society is falling apart. The system isn't working. The gaps are getting worse and worse every year. I have a blackboard. I have a little lecture in which I explain the world's reality in three sets of lines. Just drawing the lines doesn't help much. Excess of but every year, the gap between the rich and the poor nations gets worse and worse. We talk about countries developing, yet every year, the percentage of the world's population that lives in what we call the non-developed, I refuse to talk about developing, the non-developing economies, is higher than the year before. The last country to become one of the developed countries, probably Japan, managed to do it with something called the Russo-Japanese War. That is, unless you want to count Israel, which kind of got instant development by importing its population, something which really is a solution to solve, but I don't need to worry about importing the population. They've already got more than they can handle, thank you. So I think we should listen to these things. I think we should look to Latin America with hope. I think the only thing we can do is to an extent try to get off the Latins' back ourselves, not to insist they follow our model, nor to pretend that we're going to follow theirs. To look at the questions they're asking and ask them about our own society. To look at the impact we've had on our society and ask us, where do we go from there? What can we do about that? And bluntly, to allow them to be different. To expect the differences to increase, not to diminish with the years to come. To expect to hear more of crisis, more of conflict. And to allow them the right to work it out themselves with the earnest hope and, I'd say, the earnest prayer. The Christian leaders of that continent will still have time and opportunity to import a Christian dimension, a moral sense, to the extreme reshaping, extreme questioning of all traditional values, which is going to dominate that continent for at least the rest of this century. I'm extremely happy to entertain questions.
Thank you. One of the interesting phenomena of our time is that in the very period when some seminaries, some theological schools are turning away from mission studies, university scholars are picking them up. And some of the finest studies in this area are now coming out of universities. Who has the first question to address?
Very much. First of all, I should have said this at the start, it's really difficult to say if there is such a thing as Latin America. You know, what somebody living in Buenos Aires, which is, for instance, further from us than Moscow by air, and much more closely oriented to Europe than is to the U.S., has in common with a Quechua Indian on the Altiplano in Bolivia. You know, why don't you ask what you have in common with a Tibetan yak driver? You know, these people are all lumped together as Latin Americans. Mexico is perhaps the most Americanized of all. And this, in the Mexico of the Southwest, certainly is, you know, is a mixture of this. But still, the largest group of Latin Americans would have to be called peasants. Very traditional. And this is one of the things that you have a question of development. This point, again, I should. This is what I said. You try to get me to put a whole semester in half an hour, and you've got everything that's important, obviously, to tell jokes. But the judicial society is very important. You know your place, you don't expect change. And you don't see too much. I mean, sure, there's class differences, but the rich guy isn't getting any richer. You know, he lives in the same kind of thing. He gets his prestige from owning land and controlling the peasants. And the things you made about the same. And now we develop the economy. This is why development statistics just make me ill. You have a village, very traditional, working with large land. I'm not defending large land. Go on centuries. And then USA, we build a farm market road in. We give the large farmers cooperative. We always go to the large farmer. I've seen a lot of USA projects which list the top of the board. Everyone else has come to the class that I've seen. There's the one in Mexico City in the long walk. People living in cardboard farms. The middle class is 8,000. Anyway, we build our road with aid, we can support their products better. We give them a loan, they can mechanize, they produce it cheaper for the American market. And they got to take the people in the arms, the first person, a lot of time, to become consumers. And suddenly, his standard of living goes up. You know, his house gets up to buy another one, which is his house. You know, he suddenly drives a car, he puts in his swimming pool. At the same time, he doesn't need all of that.
Put them in the
EM. And gave a big subsidy to the land.
Made it very easy for them not to grow cotton.
Yeah.
It's perhaps not a good time to speak ill of Stennis, but I could say some things about his colleague, Mr. Eastland. John Wayne, too, yeah.
Expectation that all the Roman churches produce in this religion.
that teaches me Indian language. That's amazing. There are dozens of foreign countries in 2/3 Indian. But they've got an awful problem. They know it. They're dependent on foreign priests. The problem is the same thing, though. We fill apart the gap with Cubans and Puerto Ricans for a few years of larger churches. But I know major cities where people say there's, we probably get this by dying in the city to preach. The ones, we have another form of cultural imperialism. You get a lot of seminary grads training in our seminary priests for things. You discover that, his church, if you preach it, they like to go and train guys to train preachers to understand, and they don't pay them very well. And along comes the Bible Society, Wycliffe Bible Translators, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and the church, and prayer. And they say, why don't you like my life? My coordination, every people like to walk over the window. They are. And nobody in the church is.
You said that they have to find their own solutions, which I agree. But one of the solutions must be made to population control. Whatever else we might do, it will show control of the birth rate. I brought one up again. And in some countries, like Haiti and South Sudan, other countries, not really.
They're going to have to find themselves. I think they'll come to it. I think the harder we push, the longer it'll be before they come to it. Because that population control becomes another example of Western imperialism showing our value down. They will take this. In fact, look at this, we're very charged. The Brazilian government just issued a statement, they like to lose a lot of Brazilian. But they made a real issue out of, more than you need for one day. Really want it. You want to use crucified election.